I enjoy reading poetry, and poetry in translation is always a bit difficult, isn't it, to sort of get an impression of what it was like in the original language. In my opinion, the Buddha was a good poet, as far as I can tell. And you do have the words preserved in something like the old language that he would have spoken. And there's a very strong rhythm of beauty in the language there. In English, here's one of his poems. This is from the Dhammapada, and it's describing the mind. Far-ranging is the mind, and it walks alone. It's not material. It sleeps in the cave of your heart. Keep it controlled, and you're free from the bonds of death. Far-ranging is the mind, and it walks alone. It's not material. It sleeps in the cave of your heart. Keep it controlled, and you're free from the bonds of death. The mind is the most important thing in Buddhism. In other words, human experience. Buddhism is about human experience. Human experience is what passes through our minds. And it's the third of the four satipatthanas, the four presences of mindfulness. The four particular recommendations the Buddha had as to what you should apply your mindfulness to. Apply your mindfulness to your own mind. And I wanted to start off by looking at all four of the satipatthanas and how they fit together. We're now on number three. We've had a look at the body, we've had a look at feelings, now we're on the mind, and the experiences that pass through the mind will be the last one, which we'll look at in a couple of weeks. Yashibodhi is going to give a talk on dhammas. And what I thought of when I was trying to work out how these four stations, presences of mindfulness, fit together was when I used to go out in the summer into the countryside, and one of the places I used to go with my dad was here, down in Surrey. Anyone recognise this?
Three Oaks.
It's Box Hill.
Box Hill.
Oh, it's Box Hill. And I used to just go off the top and just lie there in the sun looking up at the clouds. It was beautiful. I remember in my room when I was a child, there was a picture, one of these old, sort of vaguely Pre-Raphaelite style pictures. And it showed a poor country boy lying on a sandy bank with his bare legs. One of his legs was sort of covered in this rather brown sand. And he had a red neckerchief around his neck. And wearing sort of rags, basically. And he's just shading his eyes from the sun and just lying in the sun. It's a fantastic thing to do on a country day, just to lie there and to watch the birds going over. And this is what I used to do on Box Hill. And I don't know how well this is going to work, but I thought, well, there's an analogy there for the four stations, the four presences of mindfulness. We could say the hill itself is the body. So you can be aware of the hill as you lie there. You can say that the sense of the air, particularly the temperature, is feelings. So you have a sense, maybe sometimes it's really beautifully warm. Other times maybe a cool breeze comes up, a few spots of rain, and you feel, you shiver, you feel a bit uncomfortable. There's that sense of either the pleasant or the unpleasant temperature. And then we've got the mind, the third of the foundations of mindfulness, the presences of mindfulness. And this is the sky. So the sky above you as you lie on the hill. And across the sky, the clouds move, you watch them move, the sun moves slowly, birds appear, aeroplanes with their vapor trails, kites maybe that people are flying nearby. And those are the experiences that pass through the mind, the fourth of the satipatthanas, of the presences of mindfulness. And the Buddha didn't say this exhausts all the possibilities of experience. He simply recommended that these are four particularly useful stations for your mindfulness. And he gave a lot of detail as to how you can meditate and how you can apply mindfulness to the body, the feelings, the mind, and the dharmas, the mental events, and also what the good effects could be of doing that. And there's a number of texts on this, but the most classic one is the Satipatthana Sutta, a long text where the Buddha describes how to meditate with mindfulness. And he describes the mindfulness of breathing, but he goes on and describes many other things as well. So these are the four Satipatthanas: body, feelings or sensations. And we saw when Mahabodhi gave a talk on this that the feelings are not your emotions, they're the immediate flavour of your experience, either pleasant or unpleasant, or sometimes indistinct. And then there's the mind, which I'm going to be talking about much more this evening. And then the experiences that pass through the mind. So I'm going to come on to look at the section on the mind from the sutta. But before I do that, a little bit more introduction. So if we think of what your experience is, there is always a physical aspect to it. And the senses, what comes in through your senses, that's the body. There's always a tone to that experience as well. It's always either a little bit welcome or a little bit unwelcome or maybe neutral. And there are always the specific experiences that pass through the mind. And then thirdly, there is this much more, maybe the most mysterious of all of the Satipatthanas, the mind itself, where it all happens. And it is, I hope you think it's mysterious, because I think it's extremely mysterious, the fact of human subjectivity, the fact that we are sitting here, all of us are probably, I can't be certain of this, but probably, unless we've got any zombies here, we're sitting here with awareness. There is awareness. Something is happening. And it's something that only you have privileged access to, what's happening. It's extraordinary. Each experience, each Dhamma, takes place in the context of a mind and a body, and it has a flavour. The Dhammas, the experiences, are a mixture of things. Some of them are sensed experiences. Some of them seem to be coming in through our senses. I say seem because sometimes you can be fooled, can't you, by what comes in through your senses. But colours and shapes and things we identify, there they are coming in from the outside world. Some of them are sensations in our body itself, little pains, little impressions of where our feet are, where our head is, and so on. But some of them come from, as we would say, within. Some of the experiences come into the mind, from elsewhere into the into the mind. So where do they come from? That's very strange as well, isn't it? The fact that we can have a memory popping up. Where did that come from? Or we can have an idea, we sort of make a connection between things. That pops up. Where did that come from? Or we start making a plan. What's going on there? Or just a face, somebody's face pops up in our mind, you know. Extraordinary. Very strange. So these are the birds, these are the clouds, these are the aeroplanes that pass through the sky of the mind. There are experiences, and there's a sort of an arena in which the experiences happen. And that arena is the citta. Now, the extraordinary thing, at least according to Buddhism, is that although there's definitely an arena or a sky, and there's definitely things coming into it, the experiences, there's nobody having the experiences. And we'll say a bit more about that later. But in other words, there isn't a third factor apart from mind and experiences, which is you somewhere in that mind peering out and it all sort of happening to you. There is just the mind and the experiences. And I'll say a bit later how mind and the experiences fit together. So, citta, which is the word for mind, citta can be seen in a lot of different ways. And the one way of looking at it is, it's the state of mind that you're in. So you could say it's in that sky, it's the weather in the sky, it's the climate. Sometimes it's very stormy, sometimes it's very bright and clear, sometimes it's very cold, sometimes it's very hot, and so on. So we have that sense of not just that there is the sky in which things happen, but the sky itself is influenced by what happens and is in a particular state, which we can call, by analogy, the weather, today's weather, the climate. So that's the context for your mental events. It's not neutral. We bring something to it. And we sometimes say, you know, I'm in a bad mood. If you are in a very irritable mood, you'll find that the same experience which yesterday was absolutely fine or even quite pleasant, today can be really annoying. And that's because of the climate that you bring to the experience. Experiences themselves aren't just seen completely objectively, unless you're a very unusual person. I'm sure you'll find that you bring a certain colour to them according to the mood that you're in. So that mood, that weather, that's the chitta, that's the mind. And the mind can also be grown great, the word the Buddha used, or contracted. I'll say a bit more about that later. It can be in all sorts of different ways. And this is what the relevant section of the Satipatthana Sutta goes into. It's contemplating the mind. It's saying, be mindful of the mind, but look for the presence or the absence of unwholesome states of mind, unskillful states of mind, and also of skillful states of mind. Look for lust, anger, delusion, distraction, and then look for higher states of consciousness. And that takes you in the sutta into looking at the specific events that come in after we've looked at the climate that's there. So I thought we'd look at that now, and that's why I wanted to take us through a meditation rather based on the Satipatthana Sutta, where you see whether you can just simply notice what the climate is at the moment, what there is there, what is present. So, this is what the Buddha says. He's talking to a group of monks, bhikkhus. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind as mind? In other words, how do you do the practice of being mindful of your mind? Here, a bhikkhu understands the mind affected by craving as mind affected by craving, and mind unaffected by craving as mind unaffected by craving. He understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. He understands mind affected by delusion in the same way. He understands contracted mind as a contracted mind, and distracted mind as distracted mind. He understands exalted mind as exalted mind, and unexalted mind as unexalted mind. He understands surpassed mind as surpassed mind, and unsurpassed as unsurpassed. Concentrated as concentrated, unconcentrated as unconcentrated. Liberated as liberated, and unliberated as unliberated. And then it goes on to explain how you reflect on that experience. So a little bit boring, really, isn't it? It's sort of all these different classifications, but very, very useful thing to do, to actually have a sense of where you're at. What state am I in at the moment? And it may be you don't have to label it using these labels. It may be you can just have an intuitive sense. This is the state I'm in. And in particular, contracted or expansive. Which way does it feel? Is it something I want to feed because it's very wholesome and helpful? Is it something, on the other hand, that I want to move away from? So I will actually ask you at the end of the talk, I hope there will be time, how you found doing that meditation and whether you did find yourself able to tell what sort of mental state you were in. And maybe you can give some examples. So we'll leave that until the end, but maybe you'd like to think about that a little bit, you know, how you found that as an experience. Maybe you can even do it now as you listen. What state of mind, what's the weather going on in there? You know, what's the weather forecaster would say? What would the little symbols be up on the chart? Would it be those thundery clouds? Would it be bright sunshine? Would it be fog warnings? I'm going to say a little bit more about these words in red, the particular things you're looking for. I'll just for a second move on to the next one, which is the second half of the way the Buddha teaches in the sutta. In this way, he abides contemplating mind as mind internally, or he abides contemplating mind as mind externally, or he abides contemplating mind as mind both internally and externally. Or else, he abides contemplating mind in mind its arising factors, or he abides contemplating in mind its vanishing factors, or he abides contemplating in mind both the arising and the vanishing factors. Or else, mindfulness that there is a mind is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That's how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind as mind. Although it's a bit technical, it's also rather inspiring. In a way, it's saying that this sense of knowledge and mindfulness, independence and letting go, not clinging to anything in the world, is possible simply through the practice of mindfulness. So let's go back. So the first three things you're looking out for are craving, hatred, and delusion. Does anybody recognize this trio? Have you come across it in your studies of Buddhism? Yes? No? Yes? They're called the three unwholesome roots, the three roots, akusala mula. And in a way, they are the basic ways in which, when we are in a defensive, insecure state, we'll tend to respond. Does that make sense? So this is how we interact with our experience. There's the mind. There's an experience that comes into it. Do we grab it? Do we feel, yes, 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 go, I feel a bit better with this one coming, eating biscuits. And so we go for more of that craving. Or do we push it away? Do we say, no, hang on, I want to get away from this. Do we run away from it? Do we try and destroy it? Do we say, go away? Do we sort of turn a cold shoulder? That's aversion. And then finally, are we simply confused? We don't know what's going on, actually. That's delusion. So you can say a lot more about these. They're very, very basic. But what the commentators say is that the absence of these things should be taken as a positive state. Buddhism often uses negatives to talk about positives. So the absence of craving would be taken to be contentment. The absence of hate would be taken to be metta, loving kindness. The absence of delusion would be taken to be clarity or wisdom. So also you might notice that those are there, that actually rather than feeling a lack that needs to be filled, a great void that needs to be filled, you feel fine. The biscuits turn up, you can take it or leave it. Maybe you're hungry, you'll have one, but it's not something that you need to feel okay about yourself. So in that case, you're not in a craving state, you're in a contented state. And we all know these states. It's not, don't give yourself a hard time, don't think, oh yes, I'm not enlightened, that means I'm always filled with craving, hatred and delusion. You're not. Sometimes you've got love, sometimes you've got clarity, sometimes you've got contentment. So it's just a question of noticing. The Buddha's asking you to notice. And sometimes it's difficult to be honest about it, but sometimes by the end of the day, you may suddenly say to yourself, I'm really irritable today, aren't I? I am really irritable. And this, I don't know if you can relate to this, but it's almost like a feeling of liberation once you've said that to yourself, once you've admitted it. And so, well, that explains it, It's not that necessarily that everybody has been really trying today. It's that I woke up, got out on the wrong side of the bed, and I've just been a bit ratty, basically, all day. And it's great just to say that, I think. Or maybe to notice it not as a mood that you're in all day, but at least a little microclimate that's applying to an experience that's happening at the moment. Yeah, I'm feeling needy, aren't I? I'm feeling, I want something, there's something missing. You think, oh yes, I'm feeling in that state. I'm feeling in a rather contracted, needy sort of state. And it may be you can do it without words. You just recognise it. So similarly for the other suggestions, the contracted state. He understands the contracted mind as the contracted mind, and the distracted. The contracted is this feeling that unskillful mental states have, I think, of being tight, limited, defensive. Have you ever had that when you're meditating, you feel like you're closing down? You feel like you're also just not really wanting to bother. The contracted state is one where you think, oh, blimey, I can't be bothered. I'm just going to sort of veg for a while, you know. So do you recognise that the contracted state? It's good just to notice it. I'm feeling the distracted state is interesting because in a sense it's the opposite, but it's also problematic. It's when your mind is overactive. It's jumping around like a butterfly, just landing on a flower and immediately zooming off in a completely random direction onto something else. Or the monkey in a fruit tree, which is a very powerful Buddhist image. You'll see pictures of this in Tibetan tankas, the monkey in the tree. So much fruit around it, it doesn't know what to go for. And in meditation, it can be like that sometimes. There's so many possible stimulations, so many things you could think about, so many things you could bring to mind, so many people you get annoyed with, that it just fills up your meditation with distractions. And maybe distraction is there even outside meditation. But the Buddha's not just talking about these contracted, difficult states. He's also talking about expanded states. He understands the exalted mind as the exalted mind. And the literal meaning of this is become great, if I remember right. So the mind that has become great or is becoming great. So I don't know if you can relate to that. It's as if your mind just feels bigger. It feels as if all the problems in your life are suddenly not nearly so big. You're bigger than they are. They just seem to be, they're there. They are problems, you know, but it's all right, you know. It's not the end of the world. So you've got that sense of the mind that has become great, the exalted mind. So you might notice that you're in that state. You say, oh, yes, I'm in an exalted state. There's a relaxation there. There's an opening up. Then there's the surpassed, which is interesting. Is it surpassed or is it unsurpassed? And I think this is well worth asking yourself, especially when you meditate, because it's to do with complacency. It's as if you may be that you do get a bit concentrated in the meditation, you do feel quite happy to be there, and you just think to yourself, this is enough. And the suggestion in Buddhist meditation is that there's always another step you can take. And this is not just within a meditation practice, it's in life as well. So you may feel, well, my life is okay, it's sorted out. And fair enough, nobody's going to punish you for sticking with that, for resting on your oars and just drifting down the river. But what Buddhism says is there is further you can go. So if you start thinking this is an unsurpassed state, in other words, this is a state where there's nothing that would be more wholesome, more expansive, then you're probably fooling yourself. Of course, it may be true and you're enlightened, but it may well be that it is a surpassable state. So you look at that, you say, is it a state that has something else that I could go to from it? And then life is much more interesting because you feel I haven't just arrived in the dock. I'm on the river, I'm travelling further, I'm calling in at this little port, but I'm going to move on. There's more excitement further down the river. And then concentrated mind is concentrated mind. Concentrated is particularly relevant in meditation, but at other times as well. The mind that is focused, that's unified, where there's a one-pointed attention. And this includes the higher states of consciousness, the dhyanas, the absorptions, which you may have heard of. And then finally, the liberated mind. Is the mind liberated? And again, we needn't take this in a very exalted sense. We can say, well, is there a flavour of freedom in my life? Do I feel at least sometimes as if there's a sense of, oh, that was nice to be able to drop that. It was nice not to have to get so obsessed by that. That sense of liberation and the taste of freedom, the taste of liberation, is said to be always characteristic of the Dharma, if it's genuinely the Dharma. So that's what Buddhism is about. It's about liberation. Liberation is what matters. Not being stuck. Noticing what is gripping onto you, holding you back, and seeing whether you can untangle from all that stuff and feel liberated. My image of that is when you're picking blackberries and there's a huge blackberry bush and the biggest, juiciest ones are just out of reach and you move further and further into the bush, taking the blackberries. And then you realise you're caught. All the blackberry thorns have got you around the trousers, around the back as well, maybe even in your hair, you know. And first of all, you then of course you scratch yourself when you do that. And you have to very carefully, you have to forget about being so obsessed with the biggest blackberries and very carefully unpick the thorns from yourself, you know, and move out, and then you're liberated. So that's what the Buddhist life is like. It's like escaping from a blackberry bush. Now, that sense of liberation, of the liberation of the mind, or sometimes known as the liberation of the heart, that is the liberation of citta, is a term that is given for the fruits, particularly of the metta-bhavana practice. So it's said that the liberated citta, the liberated mind or heart, is what the metta-bhavana is about. So in other words, the best way towards liberation is by cultivating a sense of friendliness and kindness to yourself and to others. So that is known as the liberation of heart through metta. And it's described as the beautiful. The word beauty is used for this kind of mental state. It's the most beautiful mental state you can be in, the liberation of the heart through metta. There's also a liberation of the heart through compassion and through joy and through equanimity and the other positive mental states. And then it goes on to talk about refinements of this process of being aware of what mental state you're in. Contemplating mind as mind internally and externally. And this means in yourself and in other people. So that's rather interesting that the Buddha suggests that you contemplate other people's minds. What I was saying at the beginning was that we don't actually know what's going on in other people's minds, do we? We can't. I mean, maybe there's such a thing as telepathy. I don't know. I've not really experienced it. But we don't really know. We don't really know what's happening in other people's minds. So how can you be mindful of mind externally? But I think it's worth trying. It's worth developing a sensitivity, an empathy, if you like. It's worth at least starting off with a sense that there are such things as other living, breathing people with awareness. Sometimes I think we live as if there aren't. We live as if we're the only aware person in the world, you know. Not through malice, but just through blindness in a way. And we forget that we're surrounded. This room is full. Each of us has a history of many decades, richness. We've got a family, we've got a background, we've got an education. We've got our triumphs and our failures. We've got our talents and weaknesses. We've got our history. We've got all sorts of things that have happened to us. And if you could just believe that about each person, the richness that's there in every person, the struggles that they've had, the difficulties they face, the suffering that's there, the death that we'll all have to face, then your life is a much richer life. You become mindful of citta externally as well as internally. Aware of others as being subjects as we are. And then it talks about the arising and vanishing factors. So what do you think that could be? What it's talking about here is to realise that the mind is always changing. It's not, you go up to the top of Box Hill, it's not as if you just get a static weather pattern. It changes, the clouds move, the rain clouds start to arrive, the sun starts to go down, it gets a bit colder. The wind gets up or whatever. And in the case of our minds, that's much, much quicker. It's changing very rapidly all the time. And maybe we get a snapshot, we think, oh, I'm in an irritable mood. And then a couple of minutes later, we realize, hang on a minute, I'm not in an irritable mood. It's gone. It may have gone because of the very fact that we were able to notice it. But it changes, and it changes because of the way we interact. Mahabodhi a couple of weeks ago spoke about how citta is a factor where we have some choice. We don't just have to put up with our mental state. We can do something about it. And applying mindfulness to it is the first thing to do. And that may well be enough, actually. You may be able to, may need to do no more than that. But when you're mindful of it, you may notice the arising and vanishing factors. What are the arising factors for irritability? What are the factors, the conditions that tend to make me put me into an irritable state? What are the vanishing factors? What is it that tends to let it move on? So this is learning about yourself as you notice the arising and vanishing factors in your life. But it may be that all this stuff is too complicated. It just gets too much. There's a buzz going on. You get a headache. You think, I can't do this anymore. You know, I can't do all this stuff of working out what's going on and noticing it all the time and running after it and all that. Just stop. Don't do anything. And this is what's meant in the next sentence. Mindfulness that there is a mind is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. So It's not a question of completely going to sleep, of just pulling the duvet over your head. You can just sit there without doing anything, without chasing anything, but just at least be there. And one of the things that Paramananda was saying on the Sangha retreat, I was just on the weekend of the Sangha retreat, was to do with the value of the breath in this. Whatever happens, the breath can always be your anchor. Just come back to the breath. And don't try to do it. Just be with the breath. So mindfulness is just established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And you notice there is a mind. You remember there is experience happening. You don't have to say this to yourself. It doesn't have to be words. But you're aware there is experience. I am still alive. It's still going on. It's not finished yet. And as a result of this, he abides independent and not clinging to anything in the world. I like that sense of independence. When anybody gained insight in the Buddha's time, he would say of them, they'd become independent within the teacher's dispensation. In other words, they no longer needed any guidance. You get to this independence if you're mindful enough. You don't need to listen to talks on the Dharma. You don't need anyone to lead you through meditation practices. You're there. You have a touchstone. You have the touchstone of your own genuine, penetrating insight experience, which tells you where to go. It's not that you're there. It's not that you're a Buddha. It's that you have an intuitive sense of what works and what doesn't work. You don't need anyone else's guidance. You're independent, and you're not clinging to anything in the world. If you are clinging, then you're not independent, by definition, I suppose. So in that case, you still need training. You're in training. So all of these ways of looking at the mind can be summed up in a very simple scheme, which is to see the mind in terms of being reactive or being creative. So looking down you could add to these lists infinitely, but looking down from the sutra itself, the craving, the hate, the delusion, the contracted mind, the distracted mind, they are parts of the reactive functioning of the mind. It's not that we have two minds, one reactive and one creative. It's that the mind can operate reactively or it can operate creatively. Reactively means that it's governed by its input. What comes into the mind determines what happens next. So if a certain person walks in the room, you will always feel downcast because your mind is reactive. If your mind is creative, you may have got to the stage where even when the very difficult person comes into the room, it's okay. Maybe you're not pretending you like them, but it's okay. They don't have to ruin your day because you're bringing a creative response to your experience. So that's the difference between the reactive and the creative mind. And you can look at that in all these terms, in terms of the delusion, the distractedness. Are you being governed? As soon as something happens interesting, do you have to go there? As soon as you spot something interesting on the web, do you have to click on the link? If you have to, it's a reactive mind. If you have a choice, it's a creative mind. In the creative mind, we have contentment, the opposite of craving, metta for hate, clarity for delusion, exalted, the mind grown great instead of contracted, an unsurpassed mind, a concentrated mind, and a liberated mind. So it's worth thinking about that. And there's a very interesting little book called Buddha Mind here, which I would recommend, short and fairly cheap, $4.99, which has a section in it called Mind Reactive and Creative that looks in detail at the reactive and the creative mind, particularly using the Tibetan Wheel of Life as an emblem for the reactive mind, that circular process. You're always going around in circles. I'll also recommend two books on the Satipatthana Sutta itself, one by the same author, Sangharakshita, called Living with Awareness, and the other by a monk called Anālyo, which is called Satipatthana, the Direct Path to Realization. This is a wonderful book. It's very, very detailed, very scholarly. So if you don't like that kind of thing, don't bother with it. But it really does go practically into the meaning of the teachings in this sutta. I say practically because the guy is a meditator. He's not just doing it in order to work out what the words used to mean in the old days. He's doing it to help you to practice mindfulness. And I'd also recommend Know Your Mind by Sangharakshita, which looks at all the different mental factors, all the different states of the mind. And there are many more, of course, but I just thought I'd give you all of those. I think we have in the bookshop. Edited by Jnanand. Yes, at least Know Your Mind was, and possibly some of the other ones as well. Did you do Living with Awareness? He did Living with Awareness as well. So what is your mind? What is your mind? And this is something which I've been thinking a lot about lately. I've been writing a book called Finding the Mind. A relatively short book, trying to have a sense of what the mind actually is. And I realised that I didn't know. And not only I don't know, but most people don't know. And there are lots of stories about people who don't know. One of my favourites is the shepherd boy who comes to see the great Tibetan sage Milarepa. 16-year-old boy. He finds this Tibetan guru clad only in a sheet, living at the top of a mountain. And he says to him, "What is my mind?" And Milarepa refuses to tell him. And he says, "Go away and have a look at it and tell me what you find." And there's a long story, I won't go into all the details, but here is the first reply that the shepherd boy gives. "Last night I tried to find out what my mind is and how it works. I observed it carefully and found that I have only one mind. However much one wants to dismiss it, it will not go away. If one tries to catch it, it cannot be grasped. If you want it to remain, it won't stay. If you release it, it won't go. You try to gather it, it can't be picked up. You try to see it, it can't be seen. If you try to understand it, it can't be known. If you think it's an existing entity and cast it off, it will not leave you. If you think it's non-existent, you feel it running on. If you think that it's if it is something illuminating, aware, wide awake, yet incomprehensible. In short, it's hard to say what the mind really is." And Milarepa sends him off to meditate on the mind. Very precocious boy. He's not sort of caught up in somebody else's ideas. That's the great thing about being 16. He's able just to look at his own experience and report what he finds when he looks at it. So I think what this illustrates, I think, is the value of trusting your experience, of introspection. Don't trust what other people say about your mind. Actually, notice what's happening. That's what meditation's about, so that you notice what your experience is like. Your mind is always there. You can't get rid of it, as the shepherd boy noticed. It's always there. So what's it up to at the moment? What's the weather like at the moment? So just introspect and ask yourself these questions. What more noble thing could there be for a human being to do than to actually be there while their life is happening, rather than being off somewhere else? So we can say some things about the mind. We can say that it's fleeting, even that it's momentary. In other words, that it's not, as soon as it feels stuck, but actually it's never stuck. It's always moving. It might be moving in the sense of, something going bang, 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 like that, you know. So it feels rather stuck. But even there, it's still vibrating. And that's why it's painful when you're stuck in one place. It's because it's as if your head is between two cast iron pipes and you bash it off one and it bashes onto the other one. So it's always fleeting. And I found a nice quote from Chogyam Trungpa, the great contemporary Tibetan teacher. He says, "The experience of oneself relating to other things is actually a momentary discrimination, a fleeting thought. If we generate these fleeting thoughts fast enough, we can create the illusion of continuity and solidity." Because it's just happening so fast, it looks as if, like a film, is made up of 24 frames per second, but actually it looks as if it's happening continuously and really. So we build up an idea, a preconception that self and other are solid and continuous. And once we have this idea, we manipulate our thoughts to confirm it and are afraid of any contrary evidence. It's this fear of exposure, this denial of impermanence that imprisons us. It's by acknowledging impermanence that there's a chance to die and the space to be reborn and the possibility of appreciating life as a creative process. So it's a risky thing to do, to acknowledge impermanence, to see the fleeting nature of the mind, the fact that you cannot grasp it, it won't stay still, this is something actually very bothersome. It's very worrying. But Trungpa is saying, go for it. Don't be scared. Go for the impermanence. Acknowledge it. And then you can die. Which doesn't sound very nice, does it? But it's as if you let go. It's as if you allow how you were to move into the past and how you are to move into the future, rather than hanging on to how you were. And if you die, you have the space to be reborn. Just die, I don't mean die literally, it means die in a figurative sense. And then you've got the possibility of appreciating life as a constantly changing creative process. So mind is impermanent. Because it's impermanent, it's very uncomfortable, because it's constantly slipping out of our grip. And going back to an ancient sutra, this is ascribed to the Buddha. It talks about this process of searching for the mind, of trying to tie it down. And the Buddha says in the Ratnachudra Sutra, searching for mind all around, he does not see it within or without. He doesn't see it in the clusters. The clusters means the factors of the personality, things like your body and your feelings and your consciousness and your tendencies and so on. So you don't see it in the clusters. He doesn't see it in the elements or in the sense fields. Unable to see consciousness, he seeks to find the trend of his mind and asks himself, whence is the genesis of mind? You know, where does it come from? And it occurs to him that where there's an object, their mind arises. So this is the result of the introspection. You notice that whenever an experience happens, whenever there's an object, there is a mind that goes with that object. Is then mind one thing and the object another? No. What is the object? Just that is the mind. If the object were one thing and the mind another, then there would be a double state of mind. So the object itself is just mind. In other words, we naturally tend to think there's me here and there's what is happening out there. But the two are completely interpenetrating. This is not really a philosophical statement. It's more just a statement of experience. It is simply happening. Experience is happening. It's not divided into two. But we inevitably, in order to explain it, we have to say there is a subject, there is an object, there's an in here, and there's an out there. But that's not what experience is actually like, I would suggest. You may disagree, and you're welcome to disagree. Object itself is just mind. Can then mind review mind? No, mind cannot review mind. As the blade of a sword cannot cut itself, so a mind cannot see itself. Moreover, vexed and pressed hard on all sides, mind proceeds without any staying power, like a monkey or like the wind. It ranges far, bodiless, easily changing, agitated by the objects of sense, with the six sense fields for its sphere, connected with one thing after another. So quite a powerful image of this mind, the vagabond mind, like the wind blowing through a forest, touching a tree, touching a deer, touching the leaves on the ground, changing the clouds as it goes, or like a monkey leaping through the trees. But it doesn't have to be like that. It can be calmed, as we'll see. And what this points to, although it doesn't say it explicitly, is this fact that I mentioned earlier, that we have experience, we have mind. Experience is united with its objects. It can't be separated from them. But there's nobody having the experience. Even William James, the great American psychologist, pioneer psychologist, says the thoughts themselves are the thinkers. You don't have a thinker having a thought. You have thoughts happening. It's very difficult to grasp this because language insists that must be a subject and object, because that's the way language works. But if you trust your experience, you may be able to have that sense that there is simply mind minding. It's just happening, the mind. You don't have to have somebody doing it, somebody watching it. And if you do want to have that, like the shepherd boy, you'll look, but you won't be able to find it, I would suggest. Although do have a look, see if you can find the self that is having these experiences. But we don't have to be a vagabond mind. We don't have to be driven through the forests like the monkey or like the wind. We can gradually liberate the citta, liberate the mind. The subjective center of our mind can't be looked at because it's never an object. You can't look at the mind. It's like the blade of a sword cutting itself. It doesn't work that way. So the mind is that which looks. So we can't study it except as an idea in the way that we can study an object of experience. The mind is the act of being aware of an object. And Buddhism says that you can't have consciousness without an object. You can't just have a bare objectless consciousness. The mind arises together with the object. There are some little refinements of this in some later Buddhist schools, which I'll try to avoid going into here, but let's just say that for now, that's the case. So really we're talking about just one thing, consciousness of an object as being one thing. It's not fixed, it's momentary, it's constantly shifting, it's an endless stream of awareness of objects, and the objects are also continuously changing as well. Each moment of consciousness arises in dependence on its object and also on what went before. So your mind is determined by the objects and also what mental state you were in when the object turned up. There are those two things that come together to determine your experience. The mind moves as the object moves. The mind cannot be a self. It can't be an independent or abiding entity of any kind, because it is so contingent on what's happening to it. This is the suggestion from Buddhism. But if you can be thoroughly present in the movement of the objects of your consciousness, you'll see that all of them are inherently unstable and they don't have any identity of their own. And this awareness, if you notice it, if you realize that the mind is not a stable thing, the objects you're looking at don't have any self-identity either, it can be a bit disturbing, but it can produce a mood of incredible serenity. Sort of even-mindedness. Something which is immune to those allurements and dangers of things. You realize that you don't have to take things so seriously. You don't have to worry about what this passing object, whether it's going to be available to you in the future, whether you can possess it and hold on to it, whether you can get rid of it if you don't like it. You don't have to worry about those things anymore. And if you can get that little glimpse of that, it's really wonderful. It's just such an incredible relief. The allurements, the pressures that the objects of experience create. Imagine not being under that sort of pressure. Not being so worried about whether you're going to meet the deadline. Not being so worried about whether you're going to, you know, impress the boss or the girlfriend or the boyfriend. Or catch the bus, you know. So you may be able to see that a purified consciousness with no me and no mine is possible. And it's just awareing. All the time there is just this process of being aware. It's wonderful. So if you can do this sort of letting go, then this is what happens. This is this second paragraph here is the problem with this frantic mind. But if you can let go, then the Buddha says, in the Samyutta Nikaya, owing to the abandonment of passion, that is the abandonment of hanging on, the support is cut off and there's no base for consciousness. Consciousness thus unestablished, consciousness with nothing to stand on, not proliferating, not performing any function, is released. Owing to its release, it is steady. You'd think that a consciousness with nothing to stand on would be very, very unstable. But the suggestion is the instability is because what we're trying to stand on is so unstable. If you can be hovering within awareness, your mind is steady. Owing to its steadiness, it's contented. It doesn't need anything. Everything's fine. Owing to its contentment, it's not agitated. Not agitated, one is totally unbound or awakened. So this is, I wouldn't like to say I understand this process, but this is the Buddha attempting to give a sense of the process of liberation, what it feels like, what you can go through to lead to awakening, in other words, to lead to Buddhahood, to lead to enlightenment. And it seems, see, it seems rather beautiful to me. This is liberation. But that does seem a long way off, probably, to most of us. I mean, in a way, it's not. It's very adjacent, but yet there seems to be a massive barrier between us and that adjacent experience of liberation. But there is a lesser kind of liberation that you can experience at any time. Your mind is already and always unbound, in a sense. It's already like that sky above Box Hill. Disturbing thoughts and impulses are the clouds and the birds and the jet planes that move across the sky. But you don't need to leap on those clouds. You don't need to turn them into a great fog. There they are. They can pass. New ones can come in. The vast blue sky in itself is always there above the clouds. So we see it in a magical way. So if you go up in a jet aircraft and you look down, and you know where you're above all the clouds, there's nothing right to the horizon, there's the floor of clouds underneath you, then you realize that incredible azure of the high sky. It's fantastic. It's so spacious. It's so huge. So the mind is like that. The mind is a blue sky. Things pass across it, but it can be, it is incredibly spacious. It's only when we clutter it too much, let too many clouds bump up against each other, that it feels very lacking in spaciousness. So our spacious mind, the fact of awareness itself, isn't spoilt by the constricting thoughts. They don't sully it. It's always just sky. It's fine. And the Buddha described it very briefly like this, but it's one of those magical statements by him. The mind is luminous when it is cleansed of the defilements that come from without. The mind is luminous. And later Buddhists took up this phrase, the luminous or shining mind, to produce this very, very beautiful image of the sense of the basic sense of awareness, the basic awareness being always shining, always bright, always in a sense pure. Now, you mustn't take that too literally or it becomes a philosophical, metaphysical statement, but yet it's very inspiring to realize that in our depths or in its heights, the mind is luminous and open and shining. I quite like this particular Buddha statue as giving that sense of the luminousness of the mind. You can almost see his awareness somehow in that face, can't you? I think at least. And the sunshine coming through the tree branches behind produces that luminousness. The mind is luminous when it's cleansed of the defilements that come from without. So we've got these very deep habits of protecting the fictitious self. They overlay our simple awareness with incrustations that hide and distort the way things are. But it doesn't have to be like that. It's possible to cleanse the mind, as it puts it here. To polish it, if you like. And the last thing I want to talk about, how are we doing? I haven't got much time, so I'll be a bit brief with this one, is a particular use of the word citta in Buddhism, which is the awakening mind, the bodhicitta. And this becomes the most important way of looking at mind in Mahayana Buddhism, in the altruistic types of Buddhism. So really these veils are us limiting our own awareness in order to be self-protective and self-interested. And the Bodhi mind, the Bodhicitta, is a mental stance that goes beyond self-interest. It's the altruistic mind, the mind that is open to self and others. And that radiance is already there. We've got all this, it's a little bit like you've got a light bulb and it's got incredibly dirty. But if you switch the light bulb on, some rays of light will still come through that dirt. So similarly with the mind of the bodhicitta is always shining. And I'm going to give you a quotation describing the bodhicitta from Shantideva, who wrote a book which is basically about the bodhicitta, which I would also recommend. One should cultivate the bodhi mind, the bodhicitta, like this. One should first earnestly meditate on the equality of oneself and others in this way. All equally experience suffering and happiness, and I must protect them as I do myself. So you're trying to overcome the sense of self-clinging, self-importance, the difference with ourselves. You're just trying to open to other people. And he's giving you some techniques, some hints as to how to do this. Even just some notions. You might argue with his arguments, but then you have another argument as to why it's well worthwhile to drop self-interest, self-clinging. Just as the body, which has many parts owing to its division into arms and so forth, should be protected as a whole, so one hand will look after the other hand, so should this entire world, which is differentiated and yet has the nature of the same suffering and happiness. Although my suffering doesn't cause pain in other bodies, nevertheless that suffering is mine and is difficult to bear because of my attachment to myself. Likewise, although I myself do not feel the suffering of another person, that suffering belongs to that person and is difficult for him to bear because of his attachment to himself. I should eliminate the suffering of others because it is suffering, just like my own suffering. I should take care of others because they are sentient beings, just as I am a sentient being. When happiness is equally dear to others and myself, then what's so special about me that I strive after happiness for myself alone? When fear and suffering are equally abhorrent to others and myself, then what's so special about me that I protect myself but not others? So in the book, it's a lovely book because he's talking to himself, or he's trying to convince himself all the way through of the value of being altruistic. And it ends up with a huge weight of argument and also of images as well, which is all about the Bodhi mind, about this altruistic mind set on enlightenment for the sake of all. So the idea of a transformation of mind in which you let go of self-preoccupation and you don't replace it with cold indifference, as you might, but with an intense concern for the well-being of everybody, including yourself. That's what you're doing with the bodhicitta. Very ambitious thing to do. But you attempt it by becoming more sensitive to the boundaries that form around yourself, around your self-interest. And you just look for ways, like these arguments, of dissolving those boundaries. And then the citta becomes the bodhicitta, the awakening mind. So I'm going to finish there. I'm just going to leave you with the main points and also an image of the bodhicitta. This is the classic image of the bodhicitta. Is in the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, who's shown holding a gem between his folded palms. And in some of the images, you'll actually see rays of light coming between the fingers. And this gem that you're holding in your palms, a bit like the calyx within an unfolded lotus bud, this gem is the bodhicitta, the bodhi mind. So that's the classic image of that in Buddhist art. Okay, I'm going to leave it there and open it up. We've got a little bit, not very long, but a little bit. If you've got any questions or any thoughts about how you found doing the meditation as well, I'd be very interested to hear.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You talked about the mind being fleeting.
Yes.
Thoughts traveling very fast, but there are many layers of thought. There are many layers in the mind, and it seems to me that the underneath the fleeting thoughts, there are constant states of mind. For example, there's the clinging, which is a state of mind, and so I don't know, which is, I suppose, think. Kind of subconscious thinking.
Yes.
And I think that would be something that would be constant underneath the fleeting thought.
I think I know what you mean, yes. And I think it is in a sense, but it's constant in its circularity. So it's not that it doesn't move, but it moves in a recurrent pattern. Mm-hmm. I think that's what happens with these subliminal thoughts that keep us in clinging or in depression or anything like that. They do actually change, but we've got ourselves locked in a cycle. And so that's the very difficult thing is to break that cycle. And the first thing you can do is just to note, that's why it's very, you notice there is clinging. If you notice there's clinging, you'll realize that you've noticed an aspect of reactive mind, of this circular process going on. So in a sense, it's never completely stuck. At least, maybe I'm being over-optimistic, but that's my sense. It's never completely stuck. It's always moving, but it may be moving in a very repetitive and confined way.
Bodhicitta synonymous with a mind that is completely metaphor? The same thing? Or is there something else about the bodhicitta?
Well, the bodhicitta has got two different meanings. One of them is, in a sense, it represents the sky behind the clouds. So it represents just the mind completely purified, which is already there somewhere. But it also represents the mind which is completely set on awakening, and it's set on awakening by dissolving boundaries. So in that sense, it's not necessarily completely metaphor. It's moving in that direction. It's got a direction to it rather than already being there. So it's not necessarily, the bodhicitta is in a way the element of mind that is moving you in an expansive direction. You could put it that way, perhaps. I think that's the way it's understood.
It seems like Shantideva's talking about others, sort of exchanging self and other.
Yeah, because he thinks that's the best way to dissolve those boundaries.
But that's what you do in the Metta-bhavana, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So it's the same thing he's talking about as you do in the Metta-bhavana, yeah. Any other thoughts, Isabel?
I still don't understand how there is no thought or mind and experience are one and the same. I have never. I have mulled that over for decades, and I can't make sense of it. Okay, or mind and think. You know, behind you there's a tapestry. Well, if I go touch it, I mean, it's there. Okay.
Yes.
I know we can go, if you're not in the woods, if there are no woods and all that one-hand clapping business, but...
We're not saying that there are not things, or even that there's not a self. But what we're saying is that our usual way of responding doesn't seem to work. It's not quite right. It's illusory. So what seems to be happening is that we have a center to our experience. That's why we think we've got a self. We think there's something there in the center. But what there's like a location which is impinged upon by our experience. It seems to come from all directions. And so we can sort of draw lines along those directions it comes, if this makes sense. And there is a center where it's coming to. So if I reach out and touch something, that touch seems to come in and it comes into me. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a thing at the center. So that's the illusion, is there being a sort of a fortress there, a guarded fortress into which all the treasure must be brought. There is just simply a location which is the center of our experience. That's my impression. But all you can do is really introspect and just ask yourself those questions. Ask yourself some of those questions that the shepherd boy asked. You know, what can I do? Can I actually tie it down? Can I find me somewhere there? And what does me look like when I find me somewhere there? So don't take it on board from other people, but just to try it, you know.
Every time one tries to do that, it's something different.
It's something different, yeah, that's right. It changes. Yes. So it's not suggesting that in sort of psychological terms, there is an empirical self. There is real experience really impinging on the center, but there's no absolute self. There isn't a thing there that it's impinging on. There isn't something which is stable and independent from the influences. There's simply the influences are meeting experience. Experience is happening. And in the end, you can even reflect on the way I was earlier on, that experience itself is unified. You can't actually separate it into an outside and an inside. There is just experience happening. Although, of course, we have taught ourselves to say that the picture is outside us. And it doesn't seem to make sense to say that it's not outside us, of course. Anyway, well, I won't say any more about that. I'll get myself into terrible trouble. Jinananda has his hand up.
I'm just wondering, you did mention, you know, that the mind is also the mind in the sense of citta is also the heart. Yeah. So, but of course, you know, when people are asked, you know, point to your mind, of course, you know, most of us here, I don't know, you know, if you pointed to your mind, where would you point? And I think most people, you do point to here, don't they?
Yeah.
So, and what do you think?
Well, if you were asked the question, point to yourself, where would you point? Here, probably, wouldn't you? Yeah. So it's interesting. So it probably depends just on what word you happen to use for it, isn't it?
Yeah.
as to where you point. And in Buddhism, there isn't a distinction really made between mind and heart. Heart, in the colloquial sense of the seat of the emotions. So in other words, where does metta happen? Where does resentment happen? It happens in the mind. Where does thinking happen? Where do memories happen? They happen in the mind. The word citta is used for both. So that's why some people translate it as heart and some as mind. It depends really what you want to, which way you want to think of it. But the emotions are happening there as well as the thoughts.
Yeah. So it's here and here.
Yes, it's here. Well, it's not even either of those places. That's just where we happen to point. I mean, sometimes it's there, isn't it? You know? And sometimes it's in Timbuktu, or at least in San Francisco.